Risky business. Risky business. Risky business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 122. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's episode is sponsored by Checkpoint Software, a company that, believe it or not, makes more than just firewalls and has done for quite a while now. If you ever meet someone who works at Checkpoint, say something like, oh wow, what's it like to work at a firewall company? And then just sit back and watch them fume. It's actually kind of funny. But yes, Checkpoint, not just firewalls. On this week's show, we're chatting to Alastair McGibbon. He was the Australian Federal Police Agent who established the multi-jurisdictional Australian High-Tech Crime Centre back in 2003. He was with the AFP for 15 years, and he actually spent most of his time there working in drug enforcement, including, obviously, investigating criminal drug syndicates, organised crime. So he'll be along this week to dispel some of the current theories doing the rounds about online criminal activity and the nature of online criminal activity. More on that later. It is a cracker of an interview, so please stay tuned for that. We'll also be joined by Checkpoint's Fred Boyesson to discuss freak show malware, highly customizable memory scrapers and stuff the hardcore bad guys use to exfiltrate card data from compromised organizations. It's virtually impossible to detect because, well, it's not widely distributed like most malware. So it's hard to get a sample of the stuff. This is hardcore stuff for hardcore people, and that's this week's sponsor interview. But first up, of course, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Below. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Pat, how you doing?
Very well. Now, mate, I know you're across the ditch, so this isn't necessarily a story of tremendous interest to you guys, but the oft-discussed Great Firewall of Australia, the censorship regime, looks like it's dying a quiet death.
I think that's a great thing. From what I've read about the implementation of the system in Australia, it really does sound like they've made quite a balls up out of it, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I just never thought this was going to get up. I had all my American, and Americans, like, they're so funny when it comes to proposed policies like this because they're like, you know, first they take your semi-automatic guns and now they're trying to censor your internet and, you know, filter your tubes and that's it. You know, you need to get organized into a militia and overthrow the government. It's like, guys, I really don't think this policy is going to get up. I mean, it was never going to be popular. There's been a hell of a backlash, and I think the government's just trying to quietly drop it.
Which I think would be a sensible thing. You know, the you read some of the, like, the list of the sites that was getting filtered, got leaked a while ago, and, you know, it's like 30% kiddie porn, and the rest is just stuff that has no business being on a filtering list.
No, no. But, I mean, it's just, it was a really stupid scheme. I mean, it was just a censorship scheme really aimed, I think, primarily at the really hardcore nasty stuff like kiddie porn stuff. But, you know, then they were going to start censoring things like, you know, anti-abortion sites, which show pictures of fetuses and, you know, things like that, which, hey, not my cup of tea, right? But if you want to look at that, hey, that's kind of, you know, I reckon you should be allowed to. And it looks like, yeah, they're just going to quietly sweep this one under the rug and just let it die a natural death.
Yeah, and good, right? I hope the we end up doing the same thing here. I mean, you said at the beginning of the intro that this maybe not would be of much interest to me being from, you know, Nouvelle-Zélande, but we actually also have internet filtering that's coming in at the moment, and the government over here is being very sneaky about it. It's not like Australia where, I mean, at least you've got, you know, people asking in Parliament saying, how does this work? How does the, you know, what performance metrics have you got out of it? How effective is it? So that there's some kind of rational debate about it. Over in New Zealand, we have a voluntary opt-in scheme that ISPs can choose to use. And there's a couple of the local ISPs have already opted in. And the general internet using public over here knows very little about it. And the list of sites that's being filtered by the process over here is not public at all. We have no way to even review what's on it. So I know some people have filed, you know, Official Information Act requests with the government to try and get a copy of the list, but both the technical methods of implementing it is fairly intrusive, and the fact that the list is secret is, you know, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah, well, I've got nothing against an opt-in list. I mean, I think that would be actually a really good idea for parents who just want to at least provide their children from some sort of protection from, you know, when you type in some harmless Google search and you wind up with some, like, really disgusting porn site turning up in, like, the top page of results.
Yeah, well, as I understand, the opt-in aspect at the moment is per ISP, not per user.
Well, that's a little bit different.
And if you don't know that your ISP has opted in, which in some cases, the ISP we use at work, I mean, in the office that I share a lateral, you know, our ISP there had had opted in, and we didn't know. You know, and it's silently dropping requests, you know, and you know, from our point of view, that could affect the accuracy of the work that we're doing.
So did you guys just turn around and just go, hey, who turned off the donkey porn?
Well, actually, I think that's more Ben Hawks' issue than mine. I escalated it to him, and he'll take care of it.
Excellent, excellent. Now, look, moving on from that, I mean, interesting stuff, but not strictly a security story. Here's a little item here that, that's interesting, not terribly controversial, I don't think, but Snow Leopard, the latest version of the Apple OS X operating system, has actually shipped with an insecure version of Flash Player. But you've got to expect that anything that gets baked into a it's an OS like that, you know, it's going to be baked into the install CD before that vulnerability gets found, and then it gets
found.
Yeah,
and also the QA process. And yeah, I mean, you can understand how they would ship with a vulnerable version, and that's fine so long as they go ahead and patch it quickly.
Well, look, either way, if anyone out there is listening and has installed Snow Leopard, you should get version 10.0.32.18 of the Flash Player, and beware of those fake ones out there that have the Trojans in them, because they're no good.
But we have not antivirus now on the Mac OS to detect those Trojans, so they'll be fine, right?
The not Trojans.
The not Trojans, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that actually brings us to our next story, where security vendors, mostly AV companies, have had a good hard chuckle at Apple's attempts to bake anti-malware into Snow Leopard.
Yeah, this is pretty hilarious. So they've released some manner of anti-malware software, and it appears to be like kind of, you know, early 90s grade signature based pattern matching with you know, like three signatures.
And it's also designed to pick up stuff that is found, you know, that you download via your browser or you get via iChat, but not via peer-to-peer. Now, what's really funny is two of the three, you know, signatures or whatever, they're Trojans that are spreading in the wild as part of a pirated version of iWork, which is on the peer-to-peer networks. So the only stuff that's actually out there spreading in the wild in any meaningful way, this won't help you.
I don't know what Apple's up to here, eh? It's just, yeah, it just sounds like fail to me, don't you think?
Look, it is a little bit fail, but I guess it's that whole learning experience for Apple. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're going through what Microsoft went through in the early days, and yeah, we're going to criticize them, and they're going to lick their wounds and then probably do a better job in the next release, but they've got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, although I'm interested to see what Apple are going to call this, given that they're at pains to not describe it as antivirus.
They'll come up with some really cool name for it.
Something shiny, yeah.
Something shiny. Shiny AV. Shiny kind of antivirus. It's not antivirus. We're Apple. We don't do things the normal way.
We don't have viruses in the first place.
That's right. But here's something to protect against those not viruses. But look, starting off somewhere, I think that this thing's probably going to get enough ridicule elsewhere, so we should just move on to the next story. And of course, the AV guys are going to bloody laugh at it because they're AV guys and they're like, haha, look at your feeble, feeble, feeble anti-malware stuff. Oh, you have much to learn. Now, in this next piece, Adam, more Twitter stuff. Apparently, there is a pretty nasty cross-site scripting flaw in Twitter that means you can tweet bad stuff to people and pwn them bad.
Yeah, so this is, you know, this is proper attacks against Twitter here, and we have cross-site scripting right in the main Twitter interface, and yeah, you read a tweet from someone and they can execute code in the context of your browser, and if you're logged in, well, your account's compromised. So this is pretty bad for Twitter, and I hope they get this fixed real quick.
Yeah, do we actually know what the XSS is? Has there been anything released?
According to the article I read, it said it was in the form used for adding third-party Twitter clients, such as TweetDeck and Twitterific. And so I gather it's in the little tag that it puts at the end of the tweet to say how you posted it.
Ah, nice. Well, that's not really going to be too hard to figure out, is it?
Well, no. I'm glad I don't have a Twitter account now.
Well, didn't you? You did set one up for a while, didn't you? And all it said was
Twitter
don't want.
I have a Twitter account, but in order to be attacked, I would actually have to log into it.
Yes, and actually use it. All right. Well, look, on to the next story. And, this is cool. Bit of an old school bug. A server-side flaw in the FTP daemon FTP daemon for our American friends, for the IIS server on Microsoft, you know, Windows. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so this is kind of funny, like an old school FTP exploit, man. I haven't seen one of them in a while. I'm certainly not in Microsoft's IIS FTP server. So apparently it requires anonymous write access to exploit, which, you know, I don't know many people who are running, you know, public access WAS servers on IIS 5.
Yeah, I don't know many people who are actually running, you know, FTP on Windows either. I mean, it would seem the less common choice, wouldn't it?
It would, for at least for an internet-facing FTP server. You see it a lot of times internal to organizations where it's kind of on by default.
Mm.
But it's probably unlikely to have anonymous write at that point.
Yeah,
I think
thought Microsoft,
one of the funny things that came out of this story was posting on the Daily Dave mailing list from Dave Attell, who said, yeah, sorry, my bad, I audited this code, you know, 10 years ago, and I guess I missed this one, oops.
Yeah, no, I believe Microsoft actually put out an advisory and said people should do a proper impact analysis before taking defensive measures. So I think they're basically saying, like, you know, have a look into this and see if it actually is going to affect you.
Yeah, well, and you know, there's mitigating factors protecting you, then yeah, you don't need to rush patch it.
And moving on, there's a cool little bit of, I suppose you'd call it proof of concept code out there that enables malware to record Skype conversations, which is, I don't know, I mean, I can't imagine that the massive, you know, fraud underground is going to rush into creating these types of Trojans to listen to people's calls, but you would admit that it's still, you know, it's kind of cool, kind of got a bit of a James Bond vibe to it.
Well, I mean, yes and no, right? I mean, the code that's been released that does this Skype sniffing isn't actually particularly Skype-specific, right? It just uses the hooks, the audio input and output on your Windows box and records it MP3s, it sends it off somewhere, which, I mean, backdoors and Trojans have been using the microphone for a long time to record the sounds that they can hear nearby, and this is really no different from that. I mean, the fact that it is designed specifically so that you can then use it to intercept Skype, okay, that's kind of packaging, but... from a technical point of view, there's nothing really exciting here, nothing that you know, actual bad people wouldn't know how to do already.
When you were a stoned 15-year-old, I'm sure you would have yelled at a few people using back orifice, right?
I couldn't possibly admit to anything like that.
But you know what I mean, right?
Back
orifice was one where you could mess around with sound and stuff like that. You're basically saying same thing, different packaging.
Yes. I mean, I think that the interesting thing was that this was commissioned, you know, to allow governments to do intercept of Skype. And that's probably the more interesting aspect of the story rather than the technical side of things.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, the crypto on it's pretty good, right? So this was actually commissioned by some feds of some description, was it?
Well, it was a Swiss programmer who wrote it for his employer, which then allegedly sold the malware to Swiss authorities for surveillance.
Oh, okay, right. Well, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. And that's, you know, that's why it's more about packaging than tech, I guess, because that's the interesting aspect.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, you know, interesting nonetheless. Another story, Adam, here, which is another old-school kind of yarn, and the Apache Software Foundation has run into a bit of trouble having one of its web servers compromised via a compromised SSH key.
Yes, so the apparent story here was that the systems that hosted the ApacheCon content had SSH keys for backing up to one of the internal Apache systems, and that ApacheCon box was owned. Then they leapfrogged back into, I believe, Minotaur.apache.org, which I gather is a shell bounce host. And then from there, there was a job to async content up to the main www.apache web server.
Mm.
Some bad guys came in, used the async to push CGI scripts out to the public access web server, and then ran them on the public access web server to gain control. Now that's, you know, a fairly straightforward, you know, sort of Unix hacking stuff. I think what's valuable about this is how open the Apache guys have been about what happened and how quick they were to respond. What I understand is that they actually spotted this hack because they have monitoring of processes running on the web server. And when they spotted rogue processes, someone got alerted and they were very quickly able to spot what was going on and work backwards from there. And then post, you know, these results on Apache.org so that we know what's going on. And I think that's this sort of openness is really important, and I hope people are paying attention to how they've dealt with it. And I think it's been a very good kind of mature process for them.
Yeah, no, look, that does sound good. And it's also like, why don't private companies like routinely do that sort of monitoring for rogue processes? I mean, that's the sort of stuff that you need to be doing if you're serious. I mean, am I right? Oh,
yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, host-based IDS like that the text changes, text file changes on disk and processes running, you know, open sockets, that sort of thing. That's, you know, very powerful tools for actually detecting compromise. You know, whereas network IDS, like most people roll in a corporate environment, is useless unless you monitor it correctly.
Mm.
So it's much better to have something that only goes off when something bad's actually happening So as to reduce the amount of false positives.
Instead of showing you all of, you know, bloody, oh, look, code red just attacked your Apache box. Like, care factor zero, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I've always been a big believer in HIDs, and it looks like in this instance it was actually managed to catch something. So that's really good. Now, before we go, interesting little story over the last few days. Vuln Disco, the Vuln Disco pack from, what are they called, Intervidus or whatever they're called?
Those people, Russian guys.
Russian guys who make a exploit pack for Canvas. They've actually released a list of all of the vulnerabilities contained in their exploit pack, which is kind of interesting. It makes for interesting reading. There's 211 bugs there. Over 100 of them are OD, apparently.
Yeah, so it's an interesting list to see out in public, because obviously part of the value of zero day is not knowing that it exists. The moment that someone knows there's a bug to look for, then it's kind of the difference between wandering around aimlessly and geocaching, right? You know there's something to find.
Mm.
So I think, you know, releasing a list like that, I know, you know, a few people I hang out with on ISV have gone, ooh, look, MySQL 5 remote root, that sounds worth looking into.
Same thing. I spoke to a couple of, like, you know, quite high-profile bug researchers, and they were like, haha, there's a couple in there I'm going to find, because it seems like they actually gave up a little bit too much detail. So it will be interesting to see over coming months how many of these bugs that, you know, just one sentence descriptions is sometimes all you need to be able to hone in and actually find that bug. So it'll be interesting to see how many advisories start popping up as a result of this, and whether or not these guys have devalued their exploit pack by just giving up that small amount of detail.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of how much extra business they get by, listing what you're buying, because obviously it's difficult to justify spending a large amount of money when you don't exactly know what there is, or you don't know what their process is for dealing with sales inquiries about what you're going to buy. Yeah, interesting, I guess, from their point of view, to see whether this results in more sales or less.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a very interesting little discussion thread happening on risky.biz in regard to the Vuln Disco pack. So if you go to risky.biz, and you'll find it in the most active forum topics or whatever down the bottom right. But that brings us to the end of this week's news, Adam. Thank you very much for joining us, as always.
All right, thanks very much, man.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at the week's news headlines. Adam, of course, is a KiwiCon organiser, and the call for papers has gone out. So if you're interested in speaking there, head to kiwicon.org for more information. It will, of course, take place in late November at Victoria University in Wellington. Now, next up, we're chatting with former federal agent Alastair McGibbon, who is now the head honcho with Surette Group, a consultancy. He was the AFP agent who set up the Australian High Tech Crime Centre back in 2003. The AHTCC brought together law enforcement agents from pretty much all state police services and put them in a federal building with a bunch of AFP agents. The whole thing's been restructured now, but it's safe to say McGibbon's work was the AFP's first serious attempt to deal with the contemporary online criminal threat. Earlier this week, I came across an interesting blog post that looked at the Albert Gonzalez thing. Now, if you've been living under a rock for the last month or so, you might not have heard that this guy, Gonzalez, is responsible for pretty much every major credit card breach or credit card number theft over the last few years. It's really quite remarkable how much he's been responsible for. Now, this blog post that I'm talking about argued that if you subtract the number of stolen credit cards attributed to Gonzalez from the total number of stolen credit card records over the period that he was active, it turns out cybercrime or data theft of that type had actually gone down if you ignore this one guy's actions. So furthermore, the blog's author argued that this could indicate that online criminal activity might not follow a normal statistical distribution. It might actually look a bit more, from a stats point of view, like terrorism, for example, small groups of highly motivated individuals using asymmetric attacks to huge effect. Well, McGibbon disagrees with pretty much all of that. All crime is asymmetric, he argues, and it's not uncommon for a single criminal syndicate to control entire criminal industrial verticals. Now, I've got that right, don't I, Alastair? You disagree with those propositions, right?
Absolutely. Mm. I'd say it's pretty much just the way a lot of crime has evolved over the years, and I'd go to some of the large-scale drug organisations to prove my point. Look at the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel. in their day, they were dominant. I mean, they owned the business.
Who are these guys? I mean, you know, remember, geeks, we're geeks.
Sure,
we
yeah.
don't know.
Sorry,
we're not ex-cops.
So in Colombia, for example, you had Pablo Escobar.
Ah, yeah.
And the Ochoa brothers, right, in the Medellin cartel. Dominant. Then the Cali cartel and the Orwella comes along and, you know, does serious damage to the Medellin cartel. They, for such a long time, if you look at any reports coming out of America, essentially controlled the cocaine supply to the world. Now, where are they now? Having been disrupted and broken up, on the last count that I saw, there was something like 300 major groups, the DEA and the Colombian officials would say, are involved in trafficking cocaine all around the world. So it's not abnormal in crime to see some people that are just dominant for a while. And let's just actually go to this concept of dominance. So Gonzalez has been linked now, Heartland, the 7-Eleven, the Hannaford and the TJ Maxx cases, right?
I think Target and JC Penney have just been tacked onto the list.
Beautiful,
as well, right?
Yeah. But clearly a guy who was hell-bent on compromising big players. You read about him sort of saying that he wanted to target the top 500 companies and the like, and clearly he had done a pretty good job of working through his list. So, look, the guy's clearly linked to, you know, a range of very significant compromises. But what I would say is that they're the compromises that we know about. Now, there therefore could be other offences that this guy has committed, but it would be a fair guess to say that there are a range of other compromises of large corporates that people don't know about. Okay? That's my first point. The next one is, this is US-based. What about what's happening in Europe? What about what's happening in Asia? And, you know, who is conducting the compromises over there? Are we going to try to pin all of those things on Gonzalez, or are there other people that are actually aggressively moving against those centralized aggregators of, you know, essentially what they're after, of course, is credit card numbers? And I don't think we should forget the fact that there is obvious active victimization against individuals at the home-based level. Now, why are criminals still doing that if there's one person who is skewing the whole figure? Because there's still money to be made.
Well, this is really interesting too, because if we look at the number of credit card records and things that have been disclosed, you know, that have been breached and then it's been found out that they've been breached over the last few years, if we actually look at how many have been attributed to Gonzalez, it looks like most of them, but that doesn't quite feel right, does it? But when you've got all of these viruses and Trojans and stuff obviously stealing millions and millions of details.
Absolutely. What that shows to me is the criminals, Gonzalez might have compromised all those credit card numbers, but he wasn't able to use them all, right? I mean, clearly, where the disconnect is between the way his business was operating and his ability to make money was he eventually needed to turn that compromised identity data into real cash. And that's clearly where his system was less efficient, because he was obviously very good at compromising credit card numbers. I mean, give that to him. And clearly he was making better money than you and I in terms of how he was able to convert that stuff to cash. But I guess what I'm saying is there are clearly criminals who are still operating very successfully, chewing away at individual users at home. And I often wonder whether we focus so much on the big compromises, because, hey, they're big, and we forget about the fact that someone with a really well-crafted piece of malware can go out and steal just as many numbers from home users and small businesses. And the difficulty we have in this country, and indeed all around the world, is no one can count those numbers.
Well, that's, yeah, it would be very hard to trace it back to an actual particular bit of malware, whereas if it's a breach at a payment process,
absolutely,
or something, you can put your finger on it pretty quick, can't you?
My point exactly. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be focused on Gonzalez. Clearly, the guy's been up to no good. And as you say, you know, they continue to pin more and more things on the guy. But that does not get around the fact that in this country and anywhere else around the world, there's no place for the individual really to go and report, hey, this individual number of mine has been compromised, because most of the time you don't even know it has been.
Mm-hmm.
You need to make the assumption, whether you've been shopping on or offline, if you've used your credit card, it's there is a very high likelihood it's been compromised. So if you went to a 7-Eleven store or JCPenney or anything else and Gonzalez has got his little sticky fingers on it from the back end, right, then you know you may have never shopped online, but your card could be compromised. And if you've gone and given your card details to a hotel or some type of airline ticket aggregator service, who knows whether they've been compromised or whether they were even legitimate. So the reality is we need to make a presumption that our credentials have been compromised. And that's the way we really should be looking at all of these discussions.
Alistair, this news just in, it turns out that Gonzalez was also responsible for the assassination of JFK and the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. Just thought I'd let you know that we've just had that update come into the newsroom now.
And the Americans are clearly solving a lot of crimes here with Gonzalez.
Yes, I think he also faked the moon landing.
Indeed. Well, I used to work with a guy who thought that. But look, I think the reality of this is that, you know, obviously a guy who was able to put together, and I saw a quote just recently from one of the assistant U.S. attorneys in this matter, who talked about how he put together teams of hackers. Now, a lot of criminals that run enterprises, whether they're on or offline, are just really good at finding people who can do good things for or bad things for them. You know, they put together syndicates of people. Now, Gonzalez clearly was focused on building syndicates to attack these centralized systems. Now, I think it is interesting because I've spent my last several years with the advent of phishing by saying things have moved to the consumer level. Mm. Clearly, it's both at the consumer level and still significant attempts to compromise, and obviously successfully, centralized systems as well. Criminals, you know, are motivated by one thing. They're motivated by you know, getting a financial advantage largely, while the rest of us can't. And so wherever there's money to be made, people will focus their efforts.
How much do you think this actually changes our perception of cybercrime? Because it used to be that we thought it was death by a thousand paper cuts, credit card number going out via malware here, maybe a little bit, you know, coming out there, skimming here, doing this, doing that. We always thought it was a very intricate death by a thousand paper cuts sort of scenario. And now that we see that, yeah, while we've still got that, we do have these big players now. Do you think it really does... do you think it really will change the perception of this crime type among the law enforcement community?
Well, in a weird way, I hope. In a weird way, I hope it doesn't, Patrick. Because the saddest thing for all of us, I think, would be if organisations in this country or elsewhere spend their time waiting for the next Gonzalez, when the simple reality is that you and I, sitting at home today, are at risk, at significant risk, of someone coming in and taking our credentials from us as we go about our normal business. And police services in the offline world have been established very much about what would be considered petty crime, which if you aggregate it is probably more significant than the organised crime. And if you look at therefore the way in which I think we need to be reacting to online crime is very much about that community policing. It is about responding to the individual who has had something small happen to them. If we sit around waiting for Heartland cases and TJ Maxx type cases, then we're really missing the point. The reality is it is both death by a thousand cuts and clearly in the case of Gonzalez, people that are going over after centralized systems. But don't establish your investigative units and your crime reporting solely for the big end of town. It needs to be delivering to us as individual citizens at the grassroots level. And that requires a fundamental change in outlook from law enforcement agencies and indeed the way they're engineered and the way they accept crime reports from individuals.
Mm-hmm. Do you also think that this bloke and his syndicate might actually, in a perverse sort of way, wind up serving as some sort of inspiration for bad guys? I mean, he'll become the pin-up guy for the underground. Do you think that's possible? That young hacklings are going to be looking at this guy and going, wow, look at all the money he made. I didn't realise that was possible. Now I'm going to dedicate myself to a life of crime.
Well, I don't know, but, you know, clearly... In this type of free flowing of information in this environment, I think it will highlight to some criminals that they can attack, you know, centralised systems or aggregating type systems like, you know, these payment systems and clearly get some big rewards. It's a wake up call for industry, but I would keep banging on that this still comes down to the individual and how they are protected by governments. And I think when we come to the online space, you know, we need to keep the eye on the fact that those card numbers that were stolen by Gonzalez were owned by individual or, you know, used by individual people. And we need to still be looking at why we're taking these actions is to protect the individual whose card was eventually aggregated by these payment places.
So, well, but that said, I mean, individuals aren't actually liable for fraudulent transactions on their cards.
But only if they spot them. I mean, does everyone check their credit card statement every month? And do they know when I buy a bus ticket and I find that it's, you know, processed by someone in a different state with a company name that doesn't look at all like, you know, the bus company? Do I sit back and go, okay, that was my bus ticket because it was $23.95. You know, a lot of people don't do that.
So are you saying that a lot of this stuff actually doesn't get detected by the cardholders?
I think an awful lot of stuff isn't detected by cardholders because I think people tend to not focus on those small things, and the difficulty with this type of crime is those small things add up to very big things. The simple issue is, I think the death by a thousand cuts analogy still works with this type of crime because most people don't realise the incremental damage done to them.
And you think perhaps Gonzalez was a sort of semi-Pablo Escobar type pioneering crime figure?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, he came from Shadow Crews, right? Mm. So if you look at the history of any good crook, they get caught doing something smaller. Some of them go and, in particular in the US, seem to cooperate with authorities for a while, then they go and do something else. Escobar, you know, started off as a petty crook and ended up as, you know, one of the largest cocaine peddlers the world ever saw, probably the largest for a time. And then, you know, ends up being gunned down and worthless to anyone. But the reality is that, you know, with any type of crime, you can have people that are dominant in a trade and eventually they either leave, get killed, get arrested, and then someone else steps into their place. I mean, what you often find, of course, is a huge fragmentation that occurs, and that type of, you know, lots of organisations stepping in to fill the demand for the product. In this case, the demand is for other criminals to get access to financial credentials. So someone has to step in to start supplying those financial credentials to the criminal groups. Will it be an individual group or a series of people? Or will it be the malware that's just roaming around, stripping it out of home computers?
Yeah, so we have to wonder whether some of Gonzalez's minions are going to go off and form their own little enterprises now that particular cash cow has been milked dry.
Absolutely.
Okay, Alistair McGibbon, well, thank you very much for joining us here on Risky Business.
Thanks, Patrick.
Alistair McGibbon, who has founded a consultancy called the Surette Group, on the line from Canberra there. Next up, it's time to have a chat to Fred Boyesson from Checkpoint Software in this week's sponsor interview. Each week, we get our sponsors on the show so they can chat about current events from a vendor perspective. And this week, we're talking about some of the tools the bad guys are using. Some guys, the team from Spider Labs, are doing a talk at Sektor, which promises to showcase what they call a freak show of custom malware, rootkits, and data exfiltration tools that the bad guys are using. It is hardcore stuff, and it's also very hard to detect. Fred Boyesson joins me now to discuss the hardcore malware. Fred, this is pretty interesting stuff, isn't it?
It's very interesting, I think. Over the last year or so, we've seen a number of attacks that we in the security industry were talking about as theoretical become real. Say 5 to 3 years ago, someone was attacking systems also for financial gain, but they were using less sophisticated attacks. And now over the last couple of years, we've seen these types of attacks, memory scraping, various types of tools really developed by professionals used to gain access to things like credit card details, get access to payment processing things. Also, various types of attacks here are going for things like slot machines and possibly ATMs and so on, all there to get to our money. So exciting and at the same time a bit frightening because the game stepped up quite a bit.
It's interesting actually because I was speaking to a friend who worked on one of the major breaches in the US. He worked in the forensics component of one of them. I can't actually say which one or who it was that I was talking to. But he made the very good point that how are you supposed to detect some of these custom-built data theft trojans, these memory scraper things, when you can't even obtain a sample? I mean, the only reason they had a sample of this thing is because they were given tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars to go in and do a post-compromise forensic analysis of these systems, and that's how they found it. But until you'd done that, you wouldn't even be able to find this thing, let alone, you know, just come up with a signature for it, because obtaining a sample is that hard. Knowing it's even there to begin with is so difficult. I mean, what do we do in this situation?
This is a challenge that I think challenge that has two types of approaches. I mean, step number one is that these malicious software needs to get on the system, so we need to be proactive and find ways of making sure that they don't in the first place. So a way of isolating things. Second one is to turn the hunt for malicious software from a reactive game based on databases and samples, sort of a blacklisting game, into a more proactive game that's more of a whitelisting game, or approving what can be running on the system. So I think it's an approach that requires these two steps.
So I mean, you think really having very strict whitelisting in these sorts of production environments is a good thing?
I think it's a very good thing. A number of these types of systems that are production based perhaps doesn't require much user interaction other than sort of approving and starting processes and so on, can definitely benefit from very hard and tight controls with whitelisting type technologies. And then we have a challenge, of course, on administrators running, say, a credit card backend or something like that, who are also using their workstations for their professional emails and browsing the internet and so on. It's about making sure that these systems are also safeguarded and secured, so that the Trojans and malware doesn't get in that way. Because I'd be assuming that the entry point into these systems would be through some type of administration machine, unless the attackers, of course, had physical access to the systems.
Well, it was actually, I mean, for most of these things in the States, they actually got in via SQL injection vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I've heard some news about that too, that they got in that way. So that's a quite well-known attack that's been around for a long time. And of course, you could deploy various types of traditional tools like firewalls and application-level firewalls and IPS systems to safeguard yourself against those.
Or you could just hire someone to maybe do a web application code review, you know what I mean, to mop up all of the dumb shit. I mean, this is what actually amazes me about these high-profile breaches in the US, is you've got really simple entry points like SQL injection and stuff, so really basic, almost script kiddie style attacks. And then you couple that with the most advanced, sophisticated, customized memory scraping hardcore malware that we've ever seen. So it seems like the entry point isn't really as what's important to these guys, because they'll always find one. I mean, if they can get in through SQL injection, they'll be able to get in through something more sophisticated once those, you know, those basic injection bugs are taken care of. But what's really amazing is once they're in there, they know how to stay in there and be persistent and own people and own them stealthily. And that's, I think, what is a little bit scary.
And own them for maybe up to years. They could use clever ways of making use of the data that they collect, of course, to stay undetected. Like, for instance, not sell a big database of credit cards that would immediately be used, but sort of in a sneak way, use a few thousand cards at a time to avoid being setting off the triggers and alert the credit card companies.
Yeah.
I'd say, well, these guys are clever. I mean, why would they go for a really difficult target to penetrate, who've done everything they should to meet with latest security requirements and done all the right things, if they can go for a soft target? It doesn't make sense for them to spend much more time and efforts and possibly even money hiring consultants and contractors to break someone that's really difficult to go through if they can find soft targets. So I'd say that's probably one of the reasons why they've gone into these traditional approaches like a SQL injection. But
That's what, you know, what they say is when you're in the jungle and there's a lion running after you, you don't have to outrun the lion, you just have to outrun the guy next to you.
Exactly. That's one part of it, of course. But I guess if you're a significant target, perhaps it's not only about running faster than the slowest guy. It's also about making sure that you keep a reasonable level, because there are significant costs involved in cleaning up after these things, not only in in IT-related things, but also the lawsuits, the court cases, and so on. I think there's been some amazing numbers thrown around from these big credit card companies that have been going after these large hacks over the last couple of years here, where there's millions of dollars spent in fines and in legal fees. So there's a lot of money that needs to go into to cleaning this up. Proactive is the way to go here. I think it's difficult to put a number on the impact that you potentially have by losing customers and losing your business, but most people do the math here and look at sort of a security ROI by looking at what the consequences would be in direct costs, and even the direct costs are they're frighteningly large if we look at those cases that happened overseas where you missed out on PCI compliance, for instance, or you missed out on something that meant that one of the big guys came after you and it's millions of dollars in fines and legal fees.
So I guess what you're saying is if we want to extend the analogy, it's not only do you have to outrun the guy next to you, but you've got to throw a few children behind you as you're running.
That's a hard one, but all right.
Okay.
I'm okay with that one.
Okay, Fred, well, we're going to wrap it up there, mate. Thank you very much for coming onto the show this week. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Checkpoint's Fred Boyes on the line there in this week's sponsor interview, taking a look at hardcore malware. And that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. I hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
What happened?